Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone and write about TV for that publication and a whole bunch of others. I am the co-author of the official annotated Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and the World of Ice and Fire, and series editor Anne Grohl. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled, a Game of Thrones / A Song of Ice and Fire blog located at BoiledLeather.com, to which George R. R. Martin himself has directed anyone who's interested in arguing about Game of Thrones to go instead of bothering him on his live journal. Isn't that exciting? And with me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am covering Game of Thrones for the Tower of the Hand, where you can also find various essays that I authored. I also have my own blog at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com, and I am one of the authors in the new ebook from the Tower of the Hand, A Hymn for Spring, which you can get on Amazon. So, and what we are doing today is one very, very quick and brief look at the last episode that aired. It's episode 9 of the Game of Thrones TV show, The Dance of the Dragons, and it has been a little bit divisive, not as much as the Sansa rape episode, but it has gathered some controversy. So let's take a quick look at just how we assess the episode for anyone who hasn't read our review. Sean, how did you like the episode?
I liked it a lot, and this is something I'm going to be touching on in a piece that should be going up, I think, later this week, that I'm now find myself in the position that the Unsullied, the viewers who haven't read the books, have been finding themselves in all along, which is I have no fucking clue what's going to happen every week, and it is amazingly fun and, like, awful and nerve-wracking. But I'm enjoying it a tremendous amount. Like, as people know, I think I watched the show live with my mother, who has not read any of the books. And now I understand how she feels every week sitting down and having no clue what's going to happen. And with regards to Stannis' conduct in the most recent episode, of course I had no idea what was going to happen. And I assumed that what was going to happen was that he wasn't going to burn Shireen to death as a sacrifice to the Lord of Light. I think probably most people assumed that. Certainly partisans of Stannis in the fan community assumed that. You know, I'm given to understand that there is reason to believe that, well, I don't know, he may or may not actually wind up doing this in the books as well. But for me, you know, there came a certain point in the storyline where I was like, wait a minute, for this to be, you know, the typical flip shit, freak out, penultimate episode of a season of Game of Thrones, they kind of need to do this. And that's when I started getting a real sick feeling in the pit of my stomach as I watched. And, you know, I think that what happened, I think they honored the gravity of it and the horror of it. I think it was difficult to watch. I think it was difficult to watch on purpose, not in an exploitative way, but in a sobering way, and in a way I appreciated. And of course it changes my opinion of Stannis as a person and as a leader, you know, to which I say good, you know, good. I'm glad. That's engaging storytelling. I missed the last thing that you said, Stefan. What did you say?
I wanted to ask whether he changed it to the worse, but I guess so.
Yeah, I think burning his daughter alive changed my impression of him for the worse. Yes, I think that's safe to say.
Good. It was just a sanity test. Mm-hmm. You know, I've written in my review that I have told people for a while now that things will change and it is natural that they will change because this is an adaption and stuff. But I always did this on kind of an academic level. You know, you see that, yes, this will happen, and somehow I fooled myself that it would involve smaller changes that don't really take away from the characters and storylines as they are in the books. You know, we get to the same place, but we do it by a different route. But this episode really was the first one in which I was genuinely as you said, like an Unsullied in the loop, something happened that I didn't really anticipate in a way as an adaptation of Game of Thrones. I mean, it became pretty obvious in the episode itself that it would happen when he sent Davos away, which is basically his walking conscience.
Yeah,
things were more or less inevitably heading that way. But before that, I always assumed yes, he will decide against it. It will be another of those Stannis does the right thing moments, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
And really, all bets are off now. We really can't know what will happen for sure. And this is not, in my opinion, a character assassination or anything.
No.
Show Stannis is a different character than book Stannis. At least I hope he won't burn her in the books. I guess it will be Melisandre who does that, but what shit do I know? And the show is its own thing now, and it is not really inconsistent with Stannis' character, what has happened. And so it was definitely done in a, as you said, in an artistically very sophisticated way. The scene was flawlessly executed, and I guess even the harshest critics have to give it that, and have given it that.
Yes, and, you know, you raised two very interesting points, I think. The first is the issue of viewing. No, actually, that one's more complex, so I'll take that one second. The first, the new first point that I'm going to address is that I think you're right that this is the first time that I, well, certainly that I felt genuinely out to sea with regards to what was happening. Because, I mean, we talked a little bit when we recorded the podcast about the beginning of the season that the changes that the show had made so far made sense because they were changes of concision and consolidation, right? So, you know,
yeah.
Jaime, instead of wandering through the Riverlands, it's Jaime who goes on the mission through Dorne, you know, to kind of condense that kind of narrative down into one storyline involving, you know, characters with a little more pull and punch for the audience. You know, Ilaria takes Arianne's role. Now it looks like she'll probably take the Darkstar's role as well. You know, combining Sansa and Jane Poole, giving Jorah Mormont the John Connington role during Tyrion's travels, and so on and so on and so on. There's one other major thing that I'm missing. Oh, and then even stuff that is kind of, well, Hardhome, I guess, counts because instead of just sending Othel Yarwick to Hardhome, you send characters who we know and care about, and obviously that's new, but it's basically consonant with what we, I think, expected to see had we been able to see what happened at Hardhome. This, by contrast, is completely new. You know, the issue of Stannis burning Shireen had not come up in a real present way. The way it did here, and certainly, you know, as I said, I didn't think he would do it based on what I knew of the character in the book. So it is a real, this really genuinely feels like wholly uncharted territory. Whether the books get there or not, it's kind of a separate issue. But my point is, I never would have thought of this as a spoiler if people hadn't said, like, did Game of Thrones just spoil a major story, you know, storyline from the books? It just seemed so separate in a way that all the other stuff that was very different didn't feel separate to me.
That was the second point?
No, that's still the first point. This was supposed to be a short episode, and once I open my mouth, I just run on and on. The second point is this. The idea that having Stannis do this is some kind of character assassination. You know, this is a long-standing bugbear of mine about which I am strident and tedious as readers of my blog and Twitter know. But it just seems bizarre to me, and always has, that when a character you like suddenly starts doing bad things in a story, it ruins the character. It may force you to change your relationship to the character and how you see the character as a person or how you see their role in the narrative. but they don't exist independent of that narrative. And it seems, you know, the example that I cited kind of going in the opposite direction on my blog is the Richard Dreyfuss character in Jaws, Hooper, the, you know, marine biologist character. In the books, he's like, in the book, just one book, there's not a Song of Jaws and Fire. in the book by Peter Benchley, that character is an asshole. Like, he's smarmy and obnoxious and a know-it-all, and he has, like, a semi-affair with Chief Brody's wife, and then he gets eaten by the shark. But it would be bizarre, like, truly bizarre, to hear someone say, "Man, I don't like Jaws. They ruined Hooper. They changed him so much, I don't even recognize that character anymore."
Yeah, it's like, well, Spielberg.
What?
Fuck Spielberg.
Yeah, I mean, that's, it's just, yes, and then let alone to get angry at Spielberg personally, which is very strange to me. So yes, you know, I like Stannis less as a person, but Stannis isn't my friend. Stannis isn't Beyonce, even. Stannis is a character in a story written by some people. And, you know, we can get into whether the what happens with him worked. You know, a lot of people say, like, oh, it felt out of nowhere. And that, I can
no,
kind of...
No, it really didn't.
Yeah, I don't think so. I disagree with that pretty strongly, obviously. But at least I feel I can at least do business with, you know? You're at least talking my language at that point.
Yeah, that's something I want to bring up anyway, because we simply don't know whether it works or not. We have to see.
Yeah.
It was one of my criticisms of the scene in my review that I said that it wasn't entirely clear whether Stannis is burning Shireen to win a battle against the Boltons because he's playing the Game of Thrones, which would be really bad, or if he is burning her because he feels an urgent need to fight the others and prevent the apocalypse, which at least casts a shadow of doubt over it and makes it a little bit more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But much of this will depend on how they depict the fallout in episode 10, and we simply don't know yet. We can't judge this specific thing yet. What we can judge, and what has been brought up often, is the foreshadowing and the pacing of all of this. And you just said that many people said it came out of nowhere, and something that I have read many times over the last few days is that it was introduced very heavy-handedly and has been foreshadowed so extensively that it almost bordered, I don't know how to say it, that it was simply too much. And this is also something that I read in many reviews, like Alan Sepinwarlow or several others, who said that it really was foreshadowed very heavily. And I don't think that this is bad. The comparison that I made was the old Greek dramas or Shakespearean drama. I mean, read one of those and you know what heavy-handed foreshadowing is, you know?
Yes, yeah.
The thing is, what made this specific scene so intense, in my experience, is that you see it coming from a mile away,
mm-hmm.
and it comes with the inevitability of an avalanche, and there is nothing you can do to stop it. You just sit there, paralyzed, and you have to watch it, because there's nothing else you can do, really. You are compelled, as Rorschach would say.
Yes.
And there is no way for you to escape the drama. There is nothing that will save her. No Deus Ex Machina who will come out of the sky and on whose back Shireen can then go to fly away on some bad green screen. And that is really what made this scene so effective in my eyes. So I wouldn't count this as a bug, but as a feature.
Absolutely. You know, just hearing you describe it that way, I'm reminded of my favorite Tori Amos song of all things, a song called Bells for Her, which is a really eerie, beautiful, sinister song that she plays on a literally on a broken piano. And the chorus is, "Can't stop what's coming, can't stop what is on its way." And that's absolutely the feeling that you get. And it's awful and intense and good, I think, you know?
Yeah, and this is also a feeling that people who are Unsullied and people who have read the books share. And this is not true, by the way, of the other heavily foreshadowed fact, which is that most likely Ollie will kill John in the next episode.
Right, right.
And because this is only obvious for people who have read the books. And this is something that I think many people miss. Because if you don't know that John will get assassinated, there is no way that those shots of Ollie are pointing that that hard in that direction.
Well, I mean, my mom said, you know, at the end, like, oh, I don't know, Shawnee, I kind of got a bad feeling about that weird kid and Jon Snow. And, but I don't...
Okay, then there is a way.
Sure, there's a way, but I would very much doubt that she's sitting there going, like, Jon Snow will literally be killed next episode. You know, I mean, obviously... There's dead, and then there's dead.
Yes.
But,
and I think here again, it is extraordinarily necessary to foreshadow this over several episodes, because else it will feel like it comes out of the blue. This is one of those moments where, as a book reader, you are predisposed to just... experience things differently, because you know what is coming every time they show this sinister look that Ollie gives John. You just know what's happening, and after one time it becomes old. But if you don't know this, it will be a much more satisfying experience, because you have it has been shown to you how the relationship between Ollie and John degrades from mere disapproval to real hatred. And this is, I guess, one of the things that they are doing right, contrary to the judgment of several people who have read the books, because you have to try and separate your knowledge, and you really can't do this,
mm-hmm.
but at least try to understand why they do it for the Unsullied, because otherwise the scene won't work.
Right, and I think another thing that we as book readers do is we overthink, we overanalyze, we treat certain throwaway things as sort of overdeterminative about how the viewing experience works. I get this a lot where people will ask, and I guess in one case, one notable case recently on my blog, the thing that was being asked about, it wasn't someone who'd read the books, but it was someone who just knew a lot about medieval history. Which I guess is kind of a similar thing. You know, they'll focus on logistical issues, like, shouldn't all these rulers have, like, a bigger retinue around them at all times? Shouldn't there be guards? Wouldn't it take longer for them to get from place to place? You know, is it really, you know, they should have taken longer to stick Stannis in the snow, or otherwise people wouldn't notice. And just in my experience, these are generally not concerns that quote-unquote normal people have when they watch this.
You know, shouldn't a cell phone work in this horror movie?
Right. Now, like to use an example where I did this myself, in Return of the King, I mean, I may have mentioned this before, in the film version of Return of the King, which I dearly love, Gandalf says to... Gimli, that they can't just let Sauron hang out in Mordor. They have to go try and draw him out, because there's 10,000 orcs in Mordor standing between Sam and Frodo and destroying the ring. Now, there's 10,000 Uruk-hai at Helm's Deep. There should be an order of magnitude more orcs in Mordor. And so that one line irritated me so badly. And I was like, you know, it makes it sound like it's no threat at all. They just beat 10,000 orcs. They can do it again. What's the big... But no normal person noticed this, you know?
I didn't.
Yeah, you didn't even. I noticed it because I have the White Tree of Gondor tattooed on my fucking arm. But normal people don't notice this kind of stuff. And, it's a tendency that I think all of us who are sort of quote-unquote experts in a thing, just by virtue of a deeper immersion than the wider audience... can fall victim to. And I do feel that the stuff about how this came out of nowhere because it didn't, you know, a little snowstorm, it doesn't seem that bad. I'm not really convinced that it reads that way to someone who isn't familiar with the chapters of people eating horses and people resorting to cannibalism.
And
they
told us that the storms are bad. And
yeah.
Sometimes you just have to take the word for it.
Yeah.
Actually, some of my readers made a comment or criticism, I'm not even sure how to describe this, which got me thinking, because I think he has a point, or she, I don't know, it was anonymous, because I was asked, how can I be so sure of my interpretations of these characters, you know, like, because I said books, Dennis wouldn't burn Shireen, and the question that I got asked was, how can you be so sure? And of course I can't, in a way. This is all my personal speculation and based on my surely flawed understanding of the material. But on the other way, if I keep everything I write and everything I say always in the balance, like on the one hand and on the other hand, it will be really boring for everyone involved. So at some point, we are making assumptions, and we are making them a little bit more pointedly than we should, just to make clear what we are about, and to really allow a discussion about it and not to retreat into the mud of, on the one hand and on the other hand, all too quickly. But yes, this is a legitimate concern. Of course, we could be wrong.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, that's what criticism is. You state your opinion.
Yes.
And without, you know, and I think that's a little bit of a lost art. And I think that's, you know, I wrote that piece for the New York Observer about four bad kinds of criticism. And I'm not sure that I actually drew this point out as clearly as I could have. But I think people are so uncomfortable with just doing sort of personal, subjective, interpretive analysis of a work and doing, you know, and coming up with, like, I don't, you know, Stannis wouldn't do that. Or Stannis, that's not in his character. That's, you know, he thinks differently, something like that. And asserting things about a character in and of himself. People are so uncomfortable with doing that that they turn to these other things for recourse that make them feel a little less like they're putting their ass out on the line a little less. So instead of just looking at a character and then stating your opinion about them, you read them through the lens of social justice or conservatism on the flip side, or you compare them to the version from the source material, or you just sort of treat them as like a real person who you just want things to work out for them, and you get angry when things don't, or you come up with elaborate theories about them that can be proven or disproven over the course of the thing. Anything to avoid just kind of stating an opinion, you know. There's an attempt to make it a sort of fact-finding mission instead of, you know, analysis and interpretation. And, there's definitely times when I hear myself saying things pretty unequivocally and kind of get a twinge of embarrassment or regret or something.
I mean, I did so only a few minutes ago. I'm definitely wrong sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's okay to be wrong. Like, I made a bet about whether Tyrion is going to be, you know, a secret Targaryen, and if I'm wrong, I owe people $60 or something like that.
Oh my god.
You know.
You really got a stake in the game.
Yeah, well, I mean, 60 whole dollars. It's not that bad. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'm wrong. You know, it's not... You know, people are wrong sometimes.
Yeah.
I certainly am. God knows I am.
Yeah, I think it can be a problem because we as critics tend to sound a little bit arrogant and know-it-all and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's kind of part of the job, because if we don't, it's boring to read. So take it as an apology of sorts.
Yes, Jesus. And it's amazing in television. This is now getting off on a tangent. I don't know how much time we have, but in television now, you read so many professional critics who do work that I enjoy, who will say things like, and you know, they'll say they don't like a show, but they'll be like, of several sentences of like, and hey, if this is still working for you, great. I want people to enjoy what they enjoy. And it's like, that goes without saying. Like, that people are going to disagree, and like, no one's going to come and arrest them for disagreeing. It's so weird that we're now so buffeted by, I don't know what the phrase, you know, but you're surrounded by opinions constantly, right? So you make an effort to be solicitous to the point where you're watering down your own ideas to please a theoretical audience that disagrees with you, which is going to disagree with you anyway. So just say what you feel. That's, I don't know. I do appreciate that about a lot of the pieces that I disagree with about the show, is that, you know, at least people are saying what they feel. Although I think that, somewhere down the middle is James Poniewozik's piece recently about Game of Thrones and Hannibal, where he was like, listen, if you like this stuff, that doesn't mean you're a sadist, and it doesn't mean the showrunners are sadists. Like, I think they're smart, I think they're wise, I think they're behaving ethically. It's artistic, and I get all that. It's just not for me. And then he's like, by the same token, if it's not for you, don't let anyone tell you you're a wuss who can't face reality. Now that, given my artistic preferences, that one I'm a little like, well, but because I like it rough. But I at least appreciate the effort to just, for him to be like, say what you feel. It's fine to feel that way. Don't overdo it.
Okay, so tell me what you feel about Dorne.
Oh, boy. Dorne, fortunately, there's only like 5 minutes left before I have to leave, because that's plenty of time to say all that needs to be said about Dorne.
It sucks so
Dorne,
hard.
Dorne is not good. Dorne is not good.
No, it really isn't. The thing I don't understand is why. It seemed so much made up at the end of season four. You know, everyone was like, oh, it's such a no-brainer, basically, to include Dorne. And we have said that sending Jaime and Bronn there, that is not a bad idea, really. And it should have worked, but it so doesn't. And it is breathtaking how bad they sucked it up.
Yeah, I don't... the fight choreography was kind of shockingly weak for this show.
Yes,
I think the outfits made them look goofy. They look like they're in a Bing Crosby road movie. The business with her taking her top off in the jail cell and him getting like boner poisoning, like that. I don't understand that either. Now, granted, I've always been a way harder on the Dornish characters, specifically Arianne, and this kind of like dusky seductress kind of 1001 Nights vibe, which I never quite felt worked. I always felt was a little bit suspect. And, the sort of reclamation of her as a progressive figure by the fandom, while I appreciate it, I never quite felt like it was borne out by the text. So I don't think what random Sand Snake number 3 did by, showing Bronn, I can't think of a funny Dorne pun. Sorry.
No, really. Or the hand clapping game. It is just so pointless. It's, sit there and think, why the fuck was this included? Mm-hmm. I mean, many people have in previous seasons always complained about the Ross scenes, for example, but never has there been anything as pointless as Dorne this season.
Yeah, it's not working for me at all. I did like the way that they ended the sequence with Bronn by having, Quentin's punishment, just having him be cold cocked. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, but it didn't fit. It really didn't fit.
Well, that's kind of what I liked about it. I liked that it didn't fit. I liked that it was just kind of out of nowhere and silly. I still think that's a head fake. I think that he'll be dying next episode, sad to say. Oh, maybe this is a good time since I really do have to leave. But what do we think is going to happen?
Yeah, okay. I mean, Cersei is going to be naked. Mm-hmm. Jon will get stabbed.
Yep.
We have to see something happening in Meereen, but I don't know exactly why.
I guess
Arya has to kill Meryn Trant and get, I guess, blinded.
Yep.
And there is a lot of stuff to cover up. Have I forgotten anything?
I think they'll free the other two dragons for some reason. I think you'll probably see some kind of grayscale situation start happening, possibly even in Stannis's camp.
My guess is that Missandei will be the one who conducts Grayscale, because she's about the only character left we care at least a fig about in Meereen, and they can kill off, because there's no way that Dany has contacted Grayscale or Tyrion, so they basically leave us only Missandei, and the love plot between her and Grey Worm has to have some purpose.
I assume Dany will run into a Khalasar.
Yeah.
I assume. We'll see. Sir Robert Strong.
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure. I think. Oh, Varys will murder Kevin.
Yes.
I
guess he teleported back.
Yep. I don't know what's going to happen with the Boltons and Stannis. That's another thing where, like, we're now past the point.
Yeah, there's absolutely no clue. But there is a lot of stuff happening, and I'm not sure how they want to put that in 60 minutes.
Me neither. And I think they'll have more than 60 minutes because I don't know for sure, and I guess maybe this information is out by now and I didn't check. But the episodes have run short for the last few weeks, and I kind of wonder if they were saving the time and the budget to make this one a little long. I will give one crazy crackpot theory about this episode.
Yeah.
Lady Stoneheart.
You think she will show up?
Yes.
Huh.
I mean, do I think she'll show up? I mean, you know, I'll bet lunch money on it just for fun. I don't know. I'm probably wrong. But the episode's called Mother's Mercy.
Okay.
And I kind of just feel that all the, you know, having Benioff and Weiss and Fairley and Martin all speak so unequivocally that she's not coming back and oh, what a shame, is all smokescreen.
Okay.
That's my guess. And, the, you know, and imagine the headlines, like, how did they pull off the shocking, you know.
I still don't really feel it, but it'll be interesting. And
I don't really know if I feel it either. I'm so, you know, it's like Oberyn poisoning, and, you know, oh, it's like the idea that Quaithe is Daenerys from the future. Like, I don't know if I really believe that, but I'm having so much fun believing it that I'm sticking with it.
I watched Interstellar this week, and I think now it has a lot more traction. Perhaps Christopher Nolan got in to sneak it in or something.
It is known.
It's definitely from the future.
All right, man. Well, thank you, as always, for talking to me. We put this together on very short notice, and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And thanks, everyone, for listening, and do check the blog. I'm sure this, when I post this, the post will be full of links to stuff that we've written about the show recently and stuff that we've read about the show recently that hopefully will enlighten and entertain you, which is our mission. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Well, another audio hour signing off, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye.